This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with Julie Giorgi, who is the coordinator of Promise Porter County. It's following up on a conversation we had yesterday with Bill Higby of the Porter County Community Foundation on one of the latest projects that the foundation, along with other partners, are working on to help get first graders in all seven Porter County school districts a chance to enroll in a program that in turn will earn them money, save money back for college or vocational training later. We'll also find out the latest on how the Lake County road projects are coming along this summer, and we'll tell you more about a popcorn stand that's getting set up in Northwest Indiana. On Regionally Speaking on Tuesday, we talked with Bill Higby with the Porter County Community Foundation. And in the conversation, Bill talked about this next topic, about the creation of a program that is going to help give opportunities for the family members and the youngsters involved of first graders, all of seven of the Porter County school districts, a chance to be able to set up savings accounts for their future education, whether it's a vocational school or the like, or whether it's college. And the program is called Promise Porter County. And here to talk about it, we have the Promise Porter County Coordinator, who is also a member of staff of the Valparaiso Family YMCA, one of those partners, along with the Community Foundation on this project. Julie Giorgi is with us. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Give us an idea what the project is all about and how it takes advantage of a statewide project that lets family members save for their youngsters' education.
I certainly will. Well, we're very excited to be bringing this to Porter County. It's been a couple of years in the making. The Promise Indiana organization has been around for about 4 years, started in Wabash, Indiana, and the idea was to enroll every first grade family that, well, they did K through three, but we are going to do first grade families in a free college savings account through College Choice 529, which is Indiana's college savings plan. So the plan is we have 28 individual schools in Porter County and over 1,800 first graders. So come next fall, we are going to be at various back-to-school events at every school, enrolling these students, the families that want to, in the program. They will get a initial deposit, generously donated by Urschel Laboratories, of $25 into their account. They don't need to do anything to get that, simply enroll, and if that's all they want to do the whole time, that's all they have to do. But we're going to also be encouraging them through some college and career curriculum in their first grade classrooms to start thinking about what it's going to mean to go to college, what they might like to do, just various aspects of heading on to post-secondary education. And then we'll have a period of time called the Champions Match, where we're going to encourage these first graders and their families to go to their champions. It may be family members, friends, coaches, teachers, anyone that they would go to, and ask them to support them in their quest to go to college.
Now, there's some interesting facts and figures that have come out here from the state, and I know you've looked them over, and I'm sure a lot of this has been some good ways to encourage support of the program. But it's a benefit for family members to get started very early in trying to set up savings accounts for their children's education.
College savings plans have come a long way in the last 10 or 15 years, and 529 plans are the best way to save for college right now. There are tax advantages. The money can be used it's generous in terms of what you do. It doesn't have to be a traditional four-year college. You can go to trade or technical schools, two-year colleges. You can use it for even textbooks and computer expenses. So they're very generous in how you can use it, and as long as they're used for educational expenses from any program that takes federal financial aid, they can withdraw the money tax-free. So that's just a huge benefit to families. And if you start early, then the money has this chance to grow. We're going to, as I was talking about the champions, we will match if the families are able to put in $25 of their own money during our champions period, which will be in October. We will match that $25 with an additional $25. So potentially by the end of October, the kids could have $75 or more in their savings account. already.
Now, take us through the start of the program. We know it's going to get underway with the beginning of the 2017-2018 school year in all of the Porter County school districts. What will parents have a chance to see or do when school starts, or maybe they'll get something in the mail before classes get underway to tell them more about this program, about the 529 College Savings Account program, as well as the local program, and how they can get involved?
Yes, we've already been in contact with every first grade family through email and through a letter that went home to kind of tell them what to look for come fall. And we will continue to be in contact with them through their school, through their individual schools, over the course of the summer as the plans finalize for their each individual enrollment. So that they will come to a back-to-school, it could be a back-to-school evening, it could be registration. Each school was able to kind of select which event they thought would work best for them. And then they will come into the school, have the opportunity to either do this online, in the computer lab, or we also have we'll have paper and pencil that if they would prefer to do that like in that way. And once they've done the online registration, because even if they do paper and pencil, they'll have to confirm online eventually. Once they do that, we'll put the money in their accounts a month or so later, and they'll be ready to go.
Now, Julie, I understand that there are going to be some very interesting activities that are going to be involved. You might have mentioned that here at the outset of our conversation, but one in particular, where participating first graders and family members are going to have a chance to visit a big campus. At least it's big to them. They're young people. They're little people. They probably aren't used to, unless they've been to Valparaiso University for other reasons, they're probably going to be very impressed with what they see.
Exactly. That's an event called Walk Into My Future, and we are going to hold that in April of 2018. And I actually was just meeting with the Valparaiso University contact today, so we're that's a great topic to talk about right now. I'm all right. Excited about it. We're going to be bringing every student onto campus for some age-appropriate activities, get them to meet some students and professors from the campus and walk around and just kind of get a feel what college is really like.
Now, have you had any questions from parents or other people about this program, and what do you tell them if they do have questions about it?
Some of the biggest questions have been about what if my child doesn't actually end up going to college, those kind of things. And so the 529 plans that have been developed are very flexible in terms of that. So if one child is just not going to go to school, the plan, you're able to transfer it to other family members. So that's a big question. Another question has been, what if my child already has a 529 plan? And we will be enrolling, even if they already have a 529 plan, if they want to transfer it into College Choice 529, then they'll get all the be eligible for all the promise grants and money that comes through our program. And if they already have a College Choice 529 plan, which is Indiana's, and they're in our cohort, which will be the first graders next school year, they will also be able to participate in every aspect of the program.
Now, if you'd like to find out more information about this particular program, the Promise Porter County program, you can go on as well, check out the website. And there's also, by the way, on Facebook, you can find out more at Promise Porter County, all one word. And then there's, I guess, a YouTube video as well, too, that explains some things, too, isn't it, Julie?
Yes, it actually shows a walk that took place last fall at Purdue University, and we've been enjoying showing that around. I think that really motivates families and children to want to participate in the program. It's pretty neat. So,
Julie Georgie is the Promise Porter County Coordinator, and she works out of the Valparaiso Family YMCA in Valparaiso, which is along with the Porter County Community Foundation. A partner in this program is getting underway this fall. A chance to get first graders started off on helping with their family members to save for college or any other educational expenses they may have in the future. Julie, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate the information. Best of luck, and hope that come the start of the school year ahead that we find out that everybody participates and is able to do so. Thank you for talking about it today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Those road construction signs are up all across Lake County these days. And let's check in and find out what road work is getting underway during the summer months. And checking in with Mark Malchewski, who is the Lake County Highway Department Supervisor. Mark, thanks for being with us. Fill us in on the construction work and how early the crews got out there to start doing the work this year.
We're going to have a pretty productive year this year. We're looking at expending probably about $4.3 million on paving. We'll do a chip and seal for about, with 30 miles of chip and seal, that's another 600,000. So crack sealing will total about over $5 million, pretty close to $5.2 million in our paving program this year. We did get a pretty early start, so we're moving right along. We've got quite a bit of our projects completed at this point in time. Klein Avenue completed, that was the 61st Avenue to Schererville. Fairbanks Street, 61st Avenue to 73rd. Broad Street, 61st Avenue to 73rd. Chase Street, 141st and up to 153rd. I could go on and on. We got quite a bit done.
That's great. Well, and we should mention also that a lot of the work that the Lake County Highway Department does is outside of the communities, the open areas in particular, especially South Lake County. Are there any big areas that are either up for work yet to be done or started or are underway right now?
We have a long list of we'll be doing 185th Avenue, White Oak to the state line, 159th Parish to Morris is being paved as of today. And that's a pretty big project. Mm-hmm. That's over a mile of road. Just different roads, 141st from Route 41 to the railroad crossing, Montgomery Street, 129th, 137th. And we did a joint venture this year with Crown Point of Iowa Street from 113th Avenue to 129th Avenue. So that's completed. So we've got quite a few roads completed.
Now tell us, for people that may not be familiar with the cooperation that you have, of course, with the communities, like in this case you just mentioned Iowa Street and working with the city of Crown Point, what kind of work do you have to set up ahead of time before any real resurfacing work, any real construction work is done on projects like those?
Well, Iowa Street was unique because we have unincorporated area, and then there's incorporated area, and then it goes to unincorporated to incorporated. So it's mixed. So we took a portion of the road. They had a portion of the road. We got together and entered into an interlocal agreement so that there was a complete project done at one time. So it worked out pretty good.
Are there any other projects that might be in the works or are being considered in the future that are going to be like that, where you have to set up interlocal agreements with the communities to get these projects going?
Yes, we're looking at one at Lake Station right now, mm-hmm. and we have yet to get an interlocal agreement done yet on that, but that probably will be forthcoming this paving season.
We've had a lot of work, I know, that have happened in the past years in open areas, and you say you have got a nice mix of communities as well as open stretches of highway that have to be reworked here. When you look at the big picture and you know of some major projects that are probably going to have to be done, you have to, of course, get the money approved from the county council and the funds that are going to have to come in. What projects do you think that the county may be able to take advantage of with the changes coming from Indianapolis and how the highway funding is going to be handled?
Well, we did the crossings grant on Ridge Road last year, mm-hmm. and that was over $1 million, and that was crossing grant money, the matching grant, and that project was $1 million. Our cost was $1,010,000, and we have our investment into it is $505,000. So that worked out real well.
Okay. I know you're always looking at work in the future here. What major projects have you got kind of lined up here once you get the approval for funding in maybe not this year, of course, but maybe the next year or two?
Well, we're talking about, we're looking at Colfax from 45th Avenue going south to 53rd or Main Street. Mm-hmm. That we're looking for grant money. And then there are a number of roads that we are considering, and I'm going to be a little reluctant to say which ones. We've studied it, and we're suggesting it to the Board of County Commissioners, some additional roads that we can use the crossings grant money.
Mm-hmm. A lot of it depends on, like you say, what money is available to be able to match with whatever county money you have or might be able to pay for a total cost of a project?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
But so far we're going along good. We break it into two phases this year, and we're getting pretty close to getting to the end of the first phase. And we're also working on a list of roads for a second phase, and in hopes that we will have the money to do the second phase.
Mark Malczewski and his crews take care of the Lake County highways, the roads outside of the communities and incorporated areas of Lake County, and working with cities and towns, if need be, for projects. Mark, thanks very much for the update, and hope that, number one, that you get everything done that you want to get done and you have enough money to do it all.
Thanks, Chris. Have a good day.
Thank you. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. A gourmet popcorn shop based in Merrillville has announced plans to expand its operation in Northwest Indiana this summer. The shop, aptly named Chicagoland Popcorn, will be popping up in St. John sometime in August in a new 1,500-square-foot facility on U.S. 41 and 82nd across from Lake Central High School. The president of Chicagoland Popcorn, Dwayne Walker, recently spoke with Lakeshore Public Radio's Dan Clark about the decision to expand their Indiana operation.
You're based in Merrillville right now. Why expand out to St. John?
Well, we actually have this very unique system that we put in place, a point-of-sale system. And my background was in IT before I decided to get into the business that I retired from, which was just basically manufacturing distribution. But one of the things we did is put a great POS system in, point-of-sale system, and we track a lot of information about our customers that join our frequent popper club, and we informally ask them where they're from. And we have a fair number of people from the St. John, Crown Point area, and when we were looking around for the next location, we did some traffic study information on a couple of sites that we were looking at, and the one that we chose in St. John we think is a perfect fit for us, and it gives us the opportunity to service a large population of our customers.
Yeah, in this press release here, you said we're excited to bring our flavors, service, corporate gifts, and established brand new customer service to this key graphic area of our expansion strategy. This expansion strategy you mentioned, is that part of this POS training or the system that you guys have in place? You're kind of trying to hit these markets where you find that you have a good base of customers?
No. Actually, what we do is we use our, I'm kind of old school. We use data to actually help us make decisions, inform decisions. We started out with a business plan that said we wanted to immerse ourselves in the communities that we do business. We didn't want to just come in and be a business that did business in the community. We wanted to become a part of the community. And so one of the things that we did is we started analyzing, and we still do look at all of our data to find out who our customers are, where they're from, as much information as we can, you know, without being, we're not intrusive to our customers. This is just demographic information for us. But one of the things that our point-of-sale system does is every time we ring someone up in our system, we have this thing called our Frequent Poppers Club. We, instead of a frequent shopper, we call it a Frequent Popper Club. And I think we're up to about 22,500 people that are in our club. And what that is every time someone comes in the store and spends $5 or more, they earn credit in our system. And after eight visits, they get a free mini bag or $5.30 off on their orders. And it's amazing how many people are taking advantage of that, repeat customers. And so we track that information in our point of sale system, and it helps us to not only justify, but helps us to plan and actually meet some of the objectives that we have in our strategic plan, which is growth, obviously.
Sure. With that, the plan to grow, you're going to St. John now. You mentioned communities like Crown Point. Are you looking to grow even further, and is that something that you see happening in the near future as well?
Well, we have a couple of a multi-pronged strategy. One of them is growing the number of locations that we have, and the other is to grow our current site that we're on right now. We're located right across from the Albanese Candy store and corporate store and the factory, the big one, not the original location down on west of 65. We're actually east of 65. And so we're right across the roadway, and we're on a four-acre parcel right across the street. And so eventually what we're going to be doing is expanding our facility here to facilitate us being able to actually service not only the St. John location, but other locations that we might add also.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the St. John location. You guys, it looks like August is the time that you're planning on unveiling the new store, and what's going to go into this store?
Well, that's our target area right now. You know, it's under, they've actually gotten the floors in now, and we're in the framing process right now. But what we're going to have in the store is it's a retail-only location, so we won't be making any of our popcorn over there. We're going to continue to make everything in our manufacturing location right here in Merrillville, and we will ship over there on an as-need basis. Several times a week, of course, to St. John, and we'll have anywhere between 90 and 120 flavors over there.
Wow, that's exciting. The flavors, I know, because I've tried them firsthand. You have quite a variety, and they're some really interesting and delicious flavors and things that you wouldn't usually think would be a flavor in popcorn. So definitely some exciting stuff.
Well, the interesting thing is that we have a suggestion jar in our store. And since opening 2.5 years ago, we're up north of 30, probably 32 or 33 flavors that we've created because of recommendations from our guests.
That is awesome. All right. Well, I'm going to have to start thinking of some stuff and giving you guys some suggestions. I don't know. It's going to be hard, though, because you do have so many already. I don't really know what's left to do. But with this new St. John location, are you guys looking to hire more people to be a part of that location, or do you already have people on hand that can service that store?
We've actually started the hiring process already, and what's funny is that before we even sent our press release out, our phone's been ringing here, and I don't know how it leaked out because we didn't even tell our employees until a couple of weeks ago. We kept it quiet until we got all of the leases signed and some of the other legwork done, but we've been getting calls already from people inquiring about working for us over in St. John. So yes, the idea is that we probably have somewhere between 8 and 10 additional staff members over there that we would between part-time and maybe even an assistant manager over there. But we have one intern that we've already hired from Purdue Northwest, and we're looking to hire another intern. We've interviewed them already, and so we're actually strategically leveraging those interns, who are great for helping us to kind of get our feet underneath us, and also helping them to get a real understanding of what it's like to be an entrepreneur. We have an entrepreneur major as our first intern, and that's who we're looking at as our second intern also, is an entrepreneur major.
I'm talking with Dwayne Walker. He's the president and CEO of Chicagoland Popcorn. And Dwayne, if someone would like to get involved in your internship program or maybe apply to work at the new St. John location, what's the best way to go about doing that?
The best thing to do is to call the store, and we have my wife and I are co-owners of the facility, and she does a much better job of interacting with the employees than I do, because I'm more behind the scenes and as much as I can be with setting up the infrastructure. But call the store at area code 219-940-1140. That's 219-940-1140, and come in and get an application and actually apply. Tell us what your interests are, and we'll see if we can accommodate.
Dwayne, thank you so much for speaking with me. This is, of course, Dwayne Walker, president of Chicagoland Popcorn, the Merrillville-based popcorn store that's expanding out into St. John, Indiana. It should be opened sometime late summer. Dwayne, thank you so much for speaking with me this afternoon.
Thank you, Dan. Have a great afternoon.
Wired magazine estimated that a human body is being about $40 million or so, so monetizing has become common. But when we need a body part to survive, are we reduced to machines? Do we own our DNA? Gerard McClendon asked the questions to Indiana University Northwest nursing professor Crystal Shannon and IU Northwest School of Public and Environmental Affairs professor Susan Zinner on a recent Counterpoint TV program.
I was notified that the two of you were two people that I just simply had to talk to today about the family, about the situation that occurred with Henrietta Lacks, and about the outstanding new movie that's coming out from Oprah Winfrey. So let's get right into this. We're looking at Henrietta Lacks, poor African-American tobacco farmer whose cells were taken without her knowledge in 1951. Dr. Zenner, can you share a little bit more of the story of Henrietta Lacks? Okay.
So as you said, she was very poor, and the family, she was born in Virginia, and then the family moved. Her husband had a job opportunity in the Baltimore area, so they were living there then. She had been having some pain. She had just given birth to her fifth child, and she wasn't sure what this pain was, and she ended up in the hospital. She, at the time, because she was African-American, there were few hospitals that would see African-American patients, but one of the hospitals that would was Johns Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And they had a blacks-only entrance, a blacks-only wing of the hospital, and that's where she sought care. And this pain that she described as feeling like a knot in her womb turned out to be cervical cancer. And she was seen by a doctor there, and because it was diagnosed at a late stage, very quickly went downhill, and she was not, it progressed so quickly that she died, I think, was it just a few months?
Just a few months later.
After being seen in the hospital.
And so what takes place before those few months, before she passes away?
Right, and so that's really the crux of what the book is about. So she is cared for by a doctor, and the doctor is trying to find some cells that will live a long time, because research is looking for a line of cells that what they're looking for, called immortal cells, cells that will live a long time, which will allow medicine to move forward. But you need the same cells to see whether you're the drugs you're investigating, everything that you're doing, what the effect will be. And that's only possible when you have cells that live a very long time.
So they're looking for, did they, okay, so, wow. So it's like Henrietta Lacks was an experiment in more ways than one. They're looking for immortal cells. Did they know that Henrietta Lacks was going to pass away soon? I mean, was this uncharted territory in terms of cervical cancer?
Well, it was a late stage cancer,
yeah.
So it was not a good diagnosis.
Right.
One of the things that the doctor is caring for her says to his colleagues at the time is, because it's a public hospital, because she's very poor, and these are patients who are not billed, is that there's kind of a quid pro quo, that he feels like maybe it's appropriate to take cells from these patients because they're unable to pay.
So it's at Johns Hopkins, there was a at the time called a colored ward of the hospital, and then whites only, for the most part. Mm-hmm. Henrietta Lacks is in the colored portion. They excavate her cells without permission, doctor?
That's correct.
Dr. Shannon?
That's correct.
So what occurs, how do you extract cells without permission from a human being? Do you just not say anything? What happened?
Well, for Henrietta Lacks, especially at that point in time, when you go back to the 50s, there wasn't a lot in terms of informing patients of different types of procedures that may be taking place on their body. And at that point, Henrietta was very ill, and in order to even determine whether or not she had the cancer cells, they had to obtain some of those cells from her. They had to evaluate her to determine whether or not she even carried those cancer cells.
So they were unaware at the time?
That's correct.
So did they know they had the so-called HeLa at that point, or they just didn't know?
They didn't know at the time. When they collected the cells, they didn't realize it yet.
Okay, so they didn't realize it yet. So when did they find out that these immortal cells that could regenerate and live outside of a human body, when did Johns Hopkins or the University of Texas or anyone that was responsible, when did they find out that this is going to be a breakthrough for all of man and womankind?
That actually didn't occur until quite some time later. Once they harvested the cells and they continued to do some evaluation on the cells, if you remember, Dr. Zenner mentioned that Henrietta, unfortunately, she didn't live very long after the diagnosis because the cancer was so advanced. But as they continue to evaluate those cells and look at those cells, they recognize that these cells didn't die off over time, like many cells, like most cells tend to do, or didn't die off from simple exposure. Instead, those cells continued to live on and even replicated in some ways. So it did take them some time to realize that the cells were still alive.
Okay. I opened the show by talking about dollars and cents. The human body is remarkable. The Wired magazine hired some doctors, surgeons, and specialists in healthcare to basically put a dollar figure on how much a human body is worth. They said it's worth $46 million. And they started fibers in the body, you know, precious substances in the body. The entire bone marrow alone is worth like $23 million. Your lungs, $58,000. Heart, $57,000. Kidneys, $91,000. Liver, $54,000. And your DNA is worth about $9 million. Okay. Now, even with the $46 million that the body is worth, the immortal life of Henrietta, this is far beyond body parts. This is regenerational. These are the first immortal cells grown outside of a human body in a culture. I told you ladies earlier, I'm emotional about this because the family wasn't compensated or even told.
That's
Dr.
Correct.
Zenner.
Well, one thing to keep in mind, though, the family wasn't told and they weren't compensated. But at the time, that was kind of standard. So no matter what the race of the person was, this might have happened anyway. And in fact, there's a case from 1990, so decades later, there's a case of a man who had leukemia. He was treated at UCLA, and he found out that he had, that a line of his cells were being used. And it's a little bit different case because it involved like body parts, but it was making his doctor wealthy, and he sued, and he lost. So the case law still shows that you do not own your body parts. It's a little bit mixed, though. It's not really clear on whether you should get a share of the profits if your doctor is making money. So
Case law says to this day or back then?
The most recent case that I know of is a 1990 case.
You don't own your own body parts.
Right. Like if you went for a biopsy or something like that and they took a lump off your body that was questionable, that is not yours.
That's not yours.
Right.
So I was diagnosed with cancer a few years ago, seminoma cancer, went through 3 cycles of chemo. They found a tumor on my aorta shaped like a butterfly. So they removed the tumor and jokingly I said, "Can I keep the tumor?" All right, pretty gross, right? Of course, the surgeon said, no, of course you can't keep the tumor. So I understand now that's got to go to research. That's not something that I own. It wasn't malignant, thank God. But case law says that I can't have something that came from my own body. Why is that? Is it because of research?
A lot of it's disposed of. Probably a small amount may be kept on file in case, like, for instance, if you were to diagnosed with cancer again, they might want that for, just to have that in your medical history. But the courts have said that what the hospital takes is not yours.
What's the takeaway, Dr. Shannon, when you first heard about this story? I'm going to be closing my first segment here shortly. What did you think? As a doctor, what did you think about Henrietta Lacks and the entire family? What was going through your mind?
Well, I'm a nurse first, and, you know, as a nurse, part of our nursing DNA says that everything we do is supposed to be about patient advocacy. So learning about the story of Henrietta Lacks, I questioned, where was the patient advocacy in all of this? Now, understanding, you know, historically in terms of informed consent and how things changed over the years, there wasn't a lot of informed consent that was readily available prior to the 70s. And that is actually around the time when Henrietta Lacks's family started to learn more about what eventually happened with her.
Yeah.
So I think it's patient advocacy.
We're going to talk more about this after the break. I just want to point this out, and I'll point it out after the break as well. Without these immortal HeLa cells, we don't have certain cancer meds. We don't have chemo. Polio vaccine comes from HeLa cells, gene mapping, in vitro fertilization, cloning. And so Henrietta Lacks, extremely important. We're all indebted to her. And the world needs to know about this.
The HeLa cell has become a very useful material for experimental work, not only in the study of cancer, but in the field of general cytology. It is easily cultivated, it exhibits many abnormalities, and is valuable for the cultivation of a wide variety of viruses.
Do you own your own cells or any body parts? What about reproducible, regenerational body parts, cell harvesting, and DNA? We're talking about the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks. Dr. Crystal Shannon and Dr. Susan Zenner join me. Thanks for sticking around for the second segment here. You've answered my question about us not owning or controlling the stuff that we came into this world with. Seems a little unfair, but I want to venture into the how the family feels at this point. What does a family feel after, you know, yes, of course, you're elated because part of my family is responsible for millions of lives being saved, for vaccines, for pretty much building pharmaceutical companies. But then there's that downside of why weren't we ever compensated and why didn't they have the respect to acknowledge us? How is the family feeling now, Dr. Shannon?
Well, one thing, I think that the book written by Rebecca Skloot is an excellent sort of review on not only Henrietta's history, but more importantly, your exact question. What does the family feel? How do they feel? How did this process affect them throughout their lives? Mm-hmm. Many of Henrietta's children actually became sick with many of the diseases that her cells were known to be supportive of and to actually cure or take care of. So knowing that not only did their mother, their grandmother, have such an important impact on scientific discovery, but also knowing that they themselves were not able to be beneficiaries of it, mm-hmm. I can only imagine that they were devastated. Mm. They felt betrayed.
This reminds me of Tuskegee a little bit.
Yes, it does.
You know, and
I think that's very relevant.
Dr. Zenner, how is that relevant? And not just in racial issues, but just in medical issues. How is this similar or just relevant as it pertains to Henrietta Lacks and the Tuskegee experience?
Well, you've got a group of people with a lot of education and a lot of power taking advantage of either a group of people or, you know, one person in the case of Henrietta Lacks, with a low socioeconomic background, not a lot of education, not aware of, you know, of what they possessed that's wanted by this group. And, you know, just kind of carries on over the years, and it's never acknowledged. You know, in response to what Dr. Shannon was saying, I wanted to mention that the family, you know, aware of the significant contribution by Henrietta Lacks, you know, they're aware of everything she's contributed. And at one point, one of her children says, you know, if she's done this much for the world, and it really is the world, how come we can't afford health insurance?
Right.
Look at that. So let's go there. Dr. Shannon, you're a nurse and a doctor. Dr. Zenner, you're a lawyer as well?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You hold a JD and an MD.
No, I'm just a JD.
JJD. Mm-hmm. Now, let's go there. Ethics. Let's talk about ethics. Because when we raise children, we want them to do the right thing, right? We want them to be fair, honest, share, play together, you know, do the right thing. And as we grow older and older, we find that adults don't do and follow the things that we tell children to do. And so where does this fall on the ethics spectrum? And will we ever witness something like this happening again? Either of you ladies want to discuss that? Because this is an ethical nightmare.
That's correct.
You know, it's, and of course, Johns Hopkins, amazing institution, horrible mistake at the time. But as you mentioned, this was customary mm-hmm. for that time. Hopefully, we'll never witness anything like this again because we have IRB, we have NIH. But where does this fall in terms of ethics? And could something like this ever happen again?
I hope it wouldn't happen again, but, you know, you just never know. I mean, I was teaching a graduate ethics class last night, and I mentioned to my students, I consider the law to be a floor and ethics to be higher than that floor. So even though something is legal, it may not necessarily make it ethical. So that's kind of what I use as a guide, that the law is the very minimum expectations that we as a society should have of behavior, and ethical behavior may demand more than what the law requires.
Is compensation an issue here? Is this a civil issue? And so I guess what I mean is, you said that ethics, you can be punished by the law, but ethics are a little higher than the law. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
But you cannot necessarily be punished criminally or in a civil manner for violating an ethics rule. Right?
Right.
That's what makes this frustrating. So let's say tomorrow morning, ladies, Gerard McClendon, host of Counterpoint, has something similar to a HeLa cell, all right? Someone takes a strand of my hair, in a hospital. I don't have jurisdiction over that strand?
Well, one thing I will mention, remember, the process of, and I've mentioned this before, the process of informed consent has dramatically changed
yes.
over the years.
Yes.
So informed consent, first and foremost, is the act of ensuring that your patient truly understands what is happening to them, truly understands what that procedure will be and what will happen as a result of that procedure. So if that involved taking a body part mm-hmm. or taking cells or taking some genetic material from you, informed consent has to be required of that patient. That patient has to sign yeah. identifying that, yes, I know exactly what's happening, I know exactly what's taking place. Unfortunately, we still have opportunities where patients are not fully aware, and this concept with regards to not understanding what's happening to them in terms of health care is a very huge concern with regards to health literacy.
This happens to this day? Right now, you think
lack
still-
of possible lack of informed consent,
yeah.
yes, that does continue to happen. However, it's our responsibility as healthcare providers to ensure that our patients receive that.
And it's the responsibility of the family to make sure that you read the documents.
Absolutely.
Because so often we get this stack of papers.
Absolutely.
Consent.
That's right.
And it could be for surgery or it could be for just making sure that the doctor takes care of you that day. And we just kind of sign away
right.
without reading. It could be two or three pages. We didn't mm-hmm. fine print and we never read it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's a two-way street, isn't
it? That's correct.
It's the health facility's responsibility as well as the family.
But it's also part of, once again, I got to go back to advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's encouraging our families to be aware that, yes, you can speak up. You can say, no, I'm not signing that because I don't understand it. Or, yes, I'd like to take this home and spend some time reviewing it. Patients and their families have that right. And, unfortunately, they're not always aware that they have that right.
This is good. Yes.
Or explain to me what this means.
That's
I don't
right.
understand these words.
That's right.
So the average informed consent form is written at the college junior reading level. And this is a little bit old, but the last data I saw said that 37% of Americans read at the college junior level. So that means about two-thirds of people signing that form don't fully understand what they're signing. Okay, and then so that means Henrietta Lacks went to, was it fourth or fifth
I think
grade?
So.
Did not understand what she was signing. So you can understand
yeah.
How this happened.
And there's literacy. And then there's selective illiteracy. Some people cannot read, illiteracy. Some people choose not to read, selective illiteracy. Mm-hmm. Once again, health facilities' responsibility, as well as making sure that the family knows what they're signing, and then the family making sure as well. Cells bought and sold by the billions. Henrietta Lacks, by the billions. And Henrietta is virtually an unknown person whose family couldn't afford health insurance. Think of that. This is worse than like college or professional sports, where they use you up for 5 years, pay you a few million, make billions off of you, and then you get CTE at 50 years old and you lose your memory or enter dementia or Alzheimer's. This is worse than that. This is, I see why it's called the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks now. This is going to last forever. Pharmaceutical companies have made billions on this. Thank God for Rebecca Skloot for writing this story and building up the courage to do the research and get the family's confidence. But this is the part that makes me angry. Billions of dollars. Yes, saving millions of lives, but billions of dollars. If this was my family, I mean, I'm mad and it's not even my family. Mm-hmm. What do we do with this?
I think part
of it. Do we just watch the Oprah Winfrey film on her and just kind of say that's a cute little story for Black history? Or do we say, no, this is an empowering moment and this cannot happen again and families need to be compensated?
I really think that the family has taken the latter stance. They've been very, very proactive about not only getting the story of Henrietta Lacks out there, but telling the cautionary tale of not being aware, not being assertive about your own health care, not being directly involved in that process. Members of Henrietta's family, her children, grandchildren, have gone on to be active members in organizations such as the National Institutes of Health in terms of making sure that proper research protocols are followed so that it never happens again.
Who made this story go? Of course, Rebecca Skloot wrote the book, but there were two people that were instrumental in making this happen. And that was the family members. What were their names?
Probably her daughter, Deborah. Was a significant part. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually the role that Oprah Winfrey is playing in the movie. Deborah played such a significant role in understanding, and or at least trying to understand, what truly happened to her mother. I remember one passage that talks about Deborah's experience of, you mean my mother's still alive?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Even though her mom had been dead for a couple of decades at that point.
And isn't that the point? Isn't that the point?
That's
this
correct.
This is, yes, it's the immortal life. This is about legacy, isn't it?
Counterpoint with Jerry McClendon airs on Friday nights at 8 o'clock on Lakeshore PBS, and it's rebroadcast on Sunday mornings at 10. Indiana wants to add a work requirement to HIP 2.0. If the federal government approves it, many in the state's unique Medicaid program would have to work or study in order to keep their insurance. But as side effect, Public Media's Jake Harper tells us the state may have skipped some important legal steps.
Indiana opened the proposal up for public comment. But before many people had time to submit anything, the state went ahead and sent its proposal to the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Judy Solomon of the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities says people in Indiana should have had a chance to weigh in.
By skirting those requirements, they've shown just an unwillingness to really consider them.
In a letter posted online, CMS said the state satisfied the requirements for the proposal to move forward. Solomon disagrees.
It's clear that this should have had a complete state comment period.
A federal comment period is now open. It closes July 9th. Jake Harper, SideFX Public Media.
Indiana tax collection surged above expectations in the month of May. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith reports on the state of Indiana's seesawing finances going into the final month of this fiscal year.
A new revenue forecast delivered in April put a damper on Indiana's tax revenue performance. The state was $34 million behind expectations after last month's poor collections. But May brought with it the second best month of tax collections this fiscal year, more than $110 million better than expected. That means the state is now nearly $77 million ahead of projections heading into the fiscal year's final month. Sales and corporate tax revenues remain above expectations. Yet despite strong collections in May, individual income tax collections continue to suffer for the fiscal year as a whole, $35 million off the mark. Fiscal year 2017 closes at the end of this month. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, Thursday, it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, of course. We'll have reporters to talk about some of the big stories in the region and elsewhere for the week, including we'll hear from the reporter for the Gary Post Tribune, Greg Tejeda. We'll also hear from Indiana business reporter Andy Ober and Indiana education reporter Eric Weddle, all coming up on Reporter Roundtable Thursday tomorrow. We hope you'll join us for that.